I enjoyed this movie more than I have enjoyed most of the last few Marvel movies.
Same.
I'm sorry, that's Sir Mark Rylance and his royal tidy whities.
We will. I'll just put a pin in those tidy whities.
I'm joking. We do not acknowledge or respect the British monarchy on this show.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, but I do respect Broadway.
Tidy-whities.
And I do have a Mark Rylance Broadway story that we can we can get.
Yes.
You can, whenever you want to hear it, I'm ready to tell it.
Okay.
All right.
Good evening and welcome to Progressively Horrified, the show where we hold horror to standards it absolutely never agreed to.
Good evening and welcome to Progressively Horrified, the podcast where we hold horror to progressive standards it never agreed to. Tonight, we're talking about a movie that feels like it was made for us, for this podcast. It's Sexy Cannibals. It's soundtracked by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Soundtracked by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. It's starring the choice twink of the 2020s, Timothée Chalamet. And it's packed full of character actors. It's Bones and All. I am your host, Jeremy Whitley. And with me tonight, I have a panel of cinephiles and cenobites. First, they're here to challenge the sexy werewolf, sexy vampire binary, my co-host, Ben Kahn. Ben, how are you tonight?
Oh, I've hit that tired level where I'm just actively disassociating. So let fucking let her rip.
All right. And the cinnamon roll of cenobites, my co-host, Emily Martin. How are you tonight, Emily?
Beep, 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 beep. Brr, that's the siren. It's in town. That's right. It's the Trent Watch. The Trent has landed. We have the full, you got to get into your storm cellar because Trent Reznor is here. He's doing the soundtrack. He's doing a song for the soundtrack. The full res with the res with the Riz is here. And he is also bringing in Joy Division and bless his heart. And Atticus Ross, I mean, he's there too.
The only government agency that we acknowledge, the Joy Division.
Yes. I don't know about that. What about Interpol?
I mean, as an intergovermental organization.
The Joy.
No, you mean the band Interpol, right?
I do mean the band Interpol that sounds like Joy Division.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Joy Division is named after the sex worker group that was forced to work for Nazi soldiers. I just want you all to know that.
Great. Fantastic.
I'm not going to exactly call that a fun fact.
Okay, well,
tonight,
if that is a
and
fact,
tonight we're watching The Night Porter.
And our guest tonight, the writer of the new comic, Deep Frog, and friend of the podcast, Tina Horn. Tina, so great to have you back.
I'm so happy to be here. I want you all to know that if I ever do get murdered, especially murdered and eaten, I do hope that when everyone who murders me goes to my house, they will look through my record collection and they will put on Kiss and they will dance around before they take a shower. That's just all you can really hope for from this life.
I mean, very as far specific. As morning rituals go.
And that they go with relatively deep cuts of Kiss too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, they don't go for any of the low-hanging fruits.
And, like,
Kiss.
We want post-makeup Kiss.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They
you
want,
know what?
Yeah, lick it up.
I'm not, suck it's up. Not dying. It's just playing with mortality, kink.
Listen. Don't get me started, / why am I here if you don't want to get me started on cannibalism fetishism.
We absolutely want to get you started. Like, that is explicitly our reason for being here, is to get you started on that exact thing. But before we get you started on that exact thing, can you tell us a little about Deep Frog?
Oh, sure.
Yes.
The cold open of Deep Frog is
that,
sort
this
of
exact
a,
thing still. Yeah.
It is about a cannibal cult, not the band Cannibal Cult, which would make a great double bill with a certain era of Kiss.
Yeah,
but
or Cannibal Corpse.
Yeah, so
I'd
Deep
have
Frog
conceived at that concert.
Gwar. Did you guys see the Gwar Tiny Desk? Anyway, that really happened. Highbrow, lowbrow. So yeah, so I am so happy to be back on one of my favorite pods and with some of my favorite gore whores. And speaking of gore whores, I have a new comic out written by me, co-created with Lisa Sterl and drawn by Lisa Sterl, who I love, and colored by Gab Contros with covers by Danny. And it's called Deprog. It's put out by Dead Sky, which is a relatively new indie imprint co-founded by Steve Wands, who's the longtime letterer of one of my other comic books, Safe Sex or SFSX. Mm-hmm. Steve is a really solid guy and asked me to pitch him a horror comic. And I had been bouncing around this idea for a while of a dyke detective who specializes in cults. And Steve was like, let's do it. And so the first issue is coming out in March 2024. And then there's going to be four issues. And then the trade will be out in September 2024. So if you like progressive horror, you like to be progressively horrified. Like, a lot of my work is about sexuality. And this has sex, but isn't about sex, which was fun for me. Also, if you like Bones and all, it definitely has a lot of the like disturbing subcultural grotesquery of this movie. So I wanted to come on and talk about this movie and let listeners know that I have this new comic out. And while we're talking about it, I also have a new literary nonfiction book out this year, June 2024, based on my podcast, Why Are People Into That?, which is about sex and kink and gender and love, from Hachette. So I've been like in a hole typing away, and like, this is a big I'm coming out year. Lots of razzle dazzle.
Dazzle them razzles.
I will. I shall.
Hell yeah.
No, yeah. It is wonderful. And all these books, fiction and nonfiction, are kinky and wonderful. I got that you shared with us the first issue, and it was so much fun.
Absolutely. It was a great book.
Thank you for that. And also thank you for bringing this movie to us, specifically me. I have a question for you, Tina.
Oh, yeah. Hit me.
And this is coming from someone who, you know, I can't smell you from here, but I feel like we are connected on a level of maybe when we were 14 years old. And we were obsessed with a person. We may have wanted to eat them. Is that, I mean, I don't want to out anybody, but.
No, it's amazing that you, I mean, I think you can smell me from there.
Okay, cool.
When you started that sentence, I really had no idea where it was going to end. I'll tell you that.
People are listening to this and they haven't watched the movie yet. That's going to be, that's like foreshadowing of things to come. It feels a little strong otherwise.
You guys listen to movie podcasts that recap movies you haven't seen?
My wife does
sometimes.
Yeah,
I cover
in a movie where I'm like, well, I'm not gonna actually see the one with the talking washing machine who teams up to solve crimes.
Is that real?
I listen to the comedians make fun of that, but I'm not actually gonna sit down and spend 90 minutes watching that.
I'll watch the YouTube video.
I don't need to rewatch Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Yes. So cannibal fetishism, aka the real life fetish practice of what is explored allegorically or like in a horror genre way in Bones and All, is something that has held my fascination for a long time. On my podcast, Why Are People Into That?, in I want to say 2019, like it, definitely pre-pandemic, I had my friend Empress Wu, who is a sort of notoriously deranged and sweet-faced dominatrix, professional dominatrix, and I had her on to talk about her cannibal fetish. And it was really eye-opening for me, stomach-opening for me, but gut-wrenching, gut-spilling for me. And it has been an incredibly popular episode of the podcast, Why Are People Into Cannibalism? And and my theory about that, besides the fact that Empress Wu is really fucking hot and smart and has lots of experiences and like raunchy stories to tell, I just think that cannibalism is ripe for metaphor. And and so I also did write a chapter about it for my book, Why Are People Into That?, out in June 2024 from Hachette Press. So if you want to know more about real life ways that you can experience the ecstasy experienced by the characters of this movie, but without non-consensually mutilating or murdering people. Those are some resources to check out.
I mean, just guessing and talking off the top of my fucking head, I have to imagine that there's something to it where, in the especially in the context of that Bones and All puts it, there's something to the literalization of how we metaphorically talk about lust.
Yes, completely. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, to that end, let's go ahead and get into talking a little bit about this film and who's in it and who made it and what happens in it. It is directed by Luca Guadagnino, who odds are, if people know, they know from his previous work with Timothée Chalamet, Call Me By Your Name, which is much creepier to watch these days.
Mm. Oh, so bad movies have cannibalism. Cool.
Weirdly, this one is less creepy now. It's based on the book written by David Kajgenek and Camille DeAngelis is working on the screenplay here. We then also have Timothée Chalamet in this movie. Taylor Russell is our lead, our main character here. We haven't covered, I don't think, any movies Taylor Russell is in. We have not talked about Escape Room or the many of sequels of Escape Room that have happened since. It also has, just giving a blockbuster character performance, Mark Rylance. And as Emily mentioned, it has the music of Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. There are a few other folks in it, but those three are the main recurring characters.
Dina, you said we've got a Mark Rylance story to enjoy tonight.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I might as well hit you with that before we get into the plot. Let's see, what year was it? It was definitely pre-pandemic. I want to say somewhere around like 2017, I had the privilege of seeing Mark Rylance in 12th Night on Broadway. And it was, in many ways, the concept was like, let's go back to basics. So it was like Elizabethan, like Globe Theater style, including a couple of key elements. One being that all of the actors were, I don't know how they all identified, but all of the women characters were played by men. And as it was in Elizabethan times, and also there were seats on the stage. Right. So Mark Rylance, what the fuck is the, I know I should have looked this up before we started. Does anybody know off the top of their heads what's the name of the protagonist of 12th Night? Is it Olivia?
Petruchio?
That's not a thing.
That's just a random, that's just random syllables that came out of my mouth.
I've got my handy Google here.
Viola.
Yeah.
Viola. Thank you. Wait, is that right?
You would know better.
No, Olivia. Olivia was the character that Rylance is playing.
Okay.
But you're correct that Viola is in 12th Night. So Rylance is in this like elaborate gowns, beautiful gowns, like, you know, the big dresses with hoops inside of them, right?
Yeah.
And doing this like special little walk in slippers, I'm sure. Like, I'm sure that underneath that big hoop skirt that he was just like,
oh yeah, doing the shuffle.
Like, he looked like he was gliding around the stage. It was very amusing to watch. Just stunning, incredible acting, some of the best that you've ever seen. And Mark Rylance is a knight and a scholar and a gentleman, obviously, and just like a consummate professional. So about halfway through the show, one of the people who was like rich or fortunate enough to have one of the seats on the stage collapsed, right? So someone might collapse in the audience at a Broadway show, but this just happened to be somebody who was like on the stage in full view of everyone, right? So of course the entire audience gasps and Rylance stops. I think it's like doing a soliloquy is the only like performer on stage. Stops, freezes in the middle of his gesture, in the middle of his soliloquy, and says, is there a medical professional in the house tonight? Now, of course, this is New York City. So of course, there were many medical professionals at this Broadway show that go running up to the stage, and a bunch of stagehands come out and whisper in Rylance's ear, and he's just completely frozen, clearly will not be moved from the stage, and is expecting everyone else to handle it. and like does not want to like shatter the illusion of the role that he's playing. So he remains frozen with his hands in the air on stage until finally like an ambulance arrives. The man is taken off stage. I'm pretty sure this person survived and ended up being fine.
Yeah.
And then a stagehand comes out and whispers in Rylance's ear again, and in character with this complete grace, like finally unfreezes, changes positions, and addresses the crowd and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, we will be back after a 15-minute intermission," and then glides off stage, like again in character. And so then everyone's like, "Whew, okay." And we're like milling about and like trying to figure out, like, is this person okay? Everything.
Yeah.
And then the lights go down. Rylance comes back on stage in the exact spot, exact position that he had frozen in when the audience member collapsed, and then started from the exact word that he had ended on, and like went right back into character, into the play, and like everybody lost their fucking shit and like applauded and just like kept going. And I was like, that is the magic of live theater. As much as I love the cinema, like that's part of what you get to experience when you see someone like on that level being like, this is how you handle an emergency.
Yeah.
Jason Statham doesn't know how to do that.
That's incredible.
I mean,
he might. He's Jason Statham. He knows how to handle a lot of things.
Clearly.
I mean, he could punch somebody out in character if, you know, there was a troublemaker in the theater. I'm sure he'd be working in the performance.
I would see like Jason Statham in like Coriolanus. That's what I want to see.
Oh, boy.
Statham's Macbeth? Get the fuck out of here.
Oh, my God. Love it.
Jason Statham's Macbeth is going to be in my head for a minute here.
It's You're just imagining decapitated Jason Statham, aren't you?
I
to spoil I just the Scottish play, everybody.
Yeah.
Oi, witches, I'm talking to you.
You fucking telling me that I'm going to be the king of Scotland?
When's the early burly done?
I say, get the fuck out. That's what I say. Is this a fucking dagger I see before me? Handle toward my hand?
I do gotta say, the emotional journey I went on seeing the Beekeeper trailer, going from, I'm not fucking seeing this, to, I fucking gotta see this. Quite the cathartic experience.
Speaking of a cathartic experience.
Yes.
This okay. The movie we're supposed to actually be talking about. Bones and all.
Let's talk about all these bones.
Yeah. Bones, dry,
bones,
wet.
Y'all.
Bones, yeah.
No, okay, so now we've done the end all, so let's get down to the bones.
Yes,
get down to the bones.
This is the bones. We opened on paintings of modern American landscapes in a gym in 1980s Virginia. Marin gets invited to a sleepover. She says she can't go because her dad won't let her. Her dad seems cool enough when we actually meet her dad until he literally locks her into her room. He, you know, lets her drive the car and seems like an okay dad until he locks her into her room.
Also, is Andre Holland, like, who doesn't want him to be your dad?
Yeah.
I mean, or, you know, or daddy, whatever. You know what I mean?
They sort of like live in the trailer park down the hill. The girl that she's supposed to be meeting up with for this sleepover, like, gives her instructions of like how to follow the power lines up to the nice part of town where she lives. Marin sneaks out the window in the middle of the night and goes to the sleepover anywhere, where she promptly bites off this girl's finger. Freshly fingernail polished fingers. I can't imagine tastes great.
You're really not emphasizing how gay this scene is, though.
It's incredible. Oh, yeah. This scene is incredibly gay, and it looks like she's about to like suck her finger, and then she just really just takes a good bite, takes that whole bottom knuckle up.
Who among us did not want to chomp on fingers at slumber parties in the 80s? I know I did.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to that once we're done with the recap, because I have
some. Look, you've heard finger licking good. This is just taking it to the next level.
You're not supposed to lick other people's fingers when it's finger licking good. You lick your own fingers.
You and I go to KFC very differently, Jeremy.
KFC comes to you is what you're saying.
She then seems startled by the fact that she's bit off this girl's finger and runs home. Her dad knows immediately what's happened and tells her to pack her things, and they take off. And we catch up with the next, now living in Maryland, where Marin wakes up to find dad's left a tape recording explaining that he is R-U-N-N-O-F-T. And
that was really when I figured out it was the 80s, was the tape recorder.
I don't know, their hair and their clothes.
Yeah, and has left her birth certificate as well. She finds out from the tape that it sounds like her mom had some of the same issue. Her dad says that her mom found a way to take care of it. Doesn't really explain what that is. But she finds on the birth certificate both where she was born and where her mother was born. So she decides that she's going to like follow that and try and go back there to find out what's going on and where she comes from, why she has this compulsive need to eat people that she has not known she has had up to this point. But we learn through the tape she has done several times, including murdering her babysitter as a child by ripping out her throat.
When she was three. We got to make that very clear. 3-year-old.
Yes.
Talk about enfant terrible.
At the same age that Johnny Cash's dad left his mom and him, she was ripping out babysitters' throats.
Is that a flex on Johnny Cash?
No, his daddy left home when he was three. Didn't leave much to his mom. Didn't leave much to my mom and me.
So take that, Johnny Cash.
Old guitar and an empty bottle of booze.
By the time your daddy was leaving you, I was already ripping out throats.
How do we know that he wasn't as well?
He is Johnny Cash.
He's the man in black.
Damn straight.
She buys apparently a map so that she can figure out where she is going and then tries to buy bus tickets to get there. She can only really get as far as Ohio, even though she's going, I believe, to Minnesota. The first stop where she has to change over buses and she's stuck outside at the bus stop, a strange man creeps up and is staring at her from a distance. We learn that this is Sully. He is played by Mark Rylance. He, like her, is an eater and informs her that he can smell her. In fact, he can tell how long it's been since she's eaten. He smelled her from several blocks away, it would seem. And he takes her back to a home where he's staying in, where there is an old woman who is in the process of dying. Sully explains to us that he does eat people, but he doesn't hurt other eaters, and he doesn't kill people. He just eats dying people or recently dead people. They eat the woman after she dies and then dry off and clean up. He shows her his totally normal rope made out of the human hair of the people that he has eaten over the course of time. It's quite long. This will be important later so that he can remember them. He wants her to stay with him so that he can teach her about being an eater. But she has a bus to catch and gets the fuck out of there. She is possibly rightfully creeped out by Sully. I think time will prove that she was rightfully creeped out by Sully. He does seem really pretty desperate, though.
You guys, the moment that we're on the bus with her and the bus is pulling out of Tent, and if you've ever ridden Greyhound or Chinatown bus, even an Amtrak, you know that feeling when you get yourself to the train station, but then the train or the bus is going past the place that you're sort of backtracking? And you go past the place that you had to leave, maybe sometimes like in a hurry to like catch the bus or catch the train. And then there's this kind of absurd thing where you're doubling back. So they're going back and they kind of come around the corner. And Mark Rylance, Sully, is standing on the corner watching the bus. It's just one of the creepiest things I've ever seen in a movie. And I think everyone here watches a lot of fucking creepy movies and everyone listening at home like watches a lot of creepy movies. It is one of the most, sorry, not sorry, bone chilling things I have ever seen in a movie, because it's just, and it's kind of that monumental horror thing that we've talked about before, right? Where it's just a man standing on a sidewalk, the way he's looking at her, like he is hurt because she's leaving, but she never agreed to stay. And if also, if you've ever had the experience of someone, especially if that person like has more social power than you, like you're a woman and like a man is like hurt that you've done something that he doesn't want you to do, but that you didn't agree to.
Yeah.
It's so fucking terrifying and like malevolent. It made me fall in love. I was like, what? Timmy hadn't even shown up yet. And I was like, I'm in love with this movie, like for that moment, if nothing else.
Yeah, like he doesn't have this like vengeful or angry look. It's a hurt look. But knowing what we know about guys like Sully, you know, Sully, our nice guy cannibal.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Sully a bit more when the next time he shows up, because I feel like the next scene that he's in is one of the most like incredibly acted scenes between the two of them.
Yeah, it's kind of the payoff of the moment that we're talking about. Yeah. But like, if you've had any interaction like that, not eating someone and then skipping town, eating someone with someone and then skipping town, but you know, like that sense of malevolent entitlement, you know that that next scene that Jeremy was just talking about is coming. But but it not it didn't feel formulaic. It felt like fully realized.
Exactly. That it's, he looks at her with hurt, but it's a hurt that you know is gonna have consequences.
Exactly.
That is the face of somebody who has been waiting for a reason.
God, that's very well
and,
said.
Oh yeah, and just got given a reason.
Yeah, who's like on the edge, and they expect their victim to be so grateful that they have been nice, and then when
when
their victim preserves themselves, then they feel betrayed because they went through all this effort to be nice this time.
It's could grooming, have done, right?
Yeah.
There's no way out of it for her. There's no way to say the right thing. There's no letting him down gently. There's no way to preserve his feelings and her safety. The two are mutually exclusive.
Yeah, absolutely. But also in that moment, because she's a quite like taciturn character, it's such a good performance by that active choice that she makes. Like, she hasn't experienced, right? How old is she? She's like, she's 16?
She says 18? She's 18.
But she's been very sheltered. She has not had a lot of life experience, but she knows she needs to get on that bus and get the fuck out of there. And she's right.
Yeah. So that scene is definitely when I was like, yeah, that guy is absolutely bad news. But there's certain things that you have to do to preserve yourself in order to, you know, in a situation like that. And that is one of those things where you're like, I'm going to go with this for now, but I'm going to keep my distance and I'm going to keep this rock in my hand. Anyway,
he does know how to spatchcock a chicken, though.
Yeah.
It's a very useful skill. She gets back on the bus. She makes it as far as Columbus this time, which is the end of what she can pay for. Before she smells another eater herself while she's stealing stuff from a convenience store. And this guy sort of clocks her as well. And then he intercedes in this sort of thing where a loud dude is harassing a woman, just generally being an asshole. And sort of like they go outside to go fight. And like she knows he's about to go kill and eat this guy. But like definitely like not the bad guy in this particular situation. And she seems not to know what to do with any of this. She then meets him back outside as he's leaving, obviously having murdered and at least partially eaten this dude. And we learn that this is Lee, our beautiful bisexual twink cannibal man.
Manic pixie cannibal boy.
Yes, our manic pixie cannibal boy.
He has a tattoo on his arm that says Adam and Eve and Steve.
Did he? I didn't notice that. That's great.
Yeah.
That's a great touch.
It's a bit on the nose, but...
I mean, there's several things with Lee that might be a little on the nose on occasion.
So, subtlety is overrated.
Yeah. So she tries to connect with him, obviously feels better about him. They decide to hang together for a while. Lee wants to go to Kentucky to help his sister learn to drive. We get sort of an indication that there's some troubled family relationships, a missing dad. He decides to take Marin back there with him. Like they go stay at his dead aunt's house. This is after they go hang out at the house of the guy that he's recently killed and go through his record collection and enjoy some Kiss, Lick It Up. They go on to Kentucky, all the great places in the world to visit. This is where he's from. They go and meet his sister. He is teaching his sister how to drive while she just sort of chills at the house. Then he takes her on a romantic date to the slaughterhouse where they hang out with cows and listen to music. Lee then eventually volunteers to take Marin to find her mom in Minnesota. This is a real, like, American Odyssey sort of bit where they identify all the states we're in at various points. It ultimately will not matter in a lot of cases, but we go to Missouri where they run into another two guys, Jake and Brad, and if you thought Sully was creepy, get ready for Brad because these guys smelled them. It turns out that Jake is an eater and Brad is a cannibal tourist. He's also a cop. On top of that, he's just got all the red flags. This guy is not compelled to eat people, but is sort of doing it for fun and curiosity. This fucks Marin up, and frankly, I agree. She's not into this dude. Her and Lee sneak out in the middle of all this after getting the name of the movie delivered to them by Jake, who talks about the first time that he ate somebody bones and all. Apparently, if you do this enough or good enough at it, at least according to him, you can eat people, including the bones. We're never told whether that's actually true or he's just fucking around. This it could be either with this guy.
Man, that's some real crimes of the future. Now you can eat bones.
I mean, yeah. There's a lot of crimes of the future shit going on here with, like, I want to test and...
Yeah, fucking David Cronenberg has a heavily highlighted copy of this book at home somewhere is all I can figure. Yeah. Like, there's just a lot of, like, notes that are like, yes, written in the margin.
You know, this movie plays with, cannibalism as allegories for a lot of things. And sometimes it feels like it's sort of operatic in its use of cannibalism as an allegory for queerness, where, like, even when people are straight, they're still queer.
Yeah.
Because they eat people. Even the idea of cannibalism as, like, an innate, born this way.
Yeah.
Desire that you have.
They're trying to be normal, definitely read like a bi for bi opposite gendered couple. Try to be like, we can get like a mortgage or try to just lean into the straight passing, even though it's not who we are.
But there are moments sometimes where you're like, okay, and Guadagnino is gay, so that helps. You know, and Timothée Chalamet wears glitter on the red carpet, so that helps.
Timothée Chalamet is literally a fucking, like, teenager's yaoi fan art magically brought to life by genie's wish.
God, like, I used to think that Dorito Face Senpai was, like, impossible standards, right? Big hands, Dorito Chip Senpai. And then I look at Timothée Chalamet, like, especially young Timothée Chalamet, and I'm like, it's real. It's real. The only thing he's missing is the shoulders that are, like, way too fucking big.
He's got crying Lucifer face.
He got crying Lucifer face.
Bring a third of a pair of jeans.
Have him sing Once in a Lifetime, and there you go. Then you Dorito Senpai Chalamet Onegaishimasu.
Like, not only is this movie packed with some of the greatest living character actors, but their roles are, sorry, not sorry, juicy as hell. And, like, this idea of someone who was not born this way, but who chooses to do it, instantly resonates as, like, every guy who got, like, one drunken blowjob and is, like, as a member of the queer community. Or, like, every person who has been to, like, one bondage a-go-go night in San Francisco and is like, I'm kinky. I understand kinky things. It's like this sort of, like, sexual subculture appropriation allegory of that character. And it's basically just one scene.
I gotta admit, I was surprised that did not come back.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, the characters.
Those guys.
Yeah. Jake and Brad. Like, Michael Stolberg is great.
Love Stolberg.
I did not realize that Brad was the director of Pineapple Express. That's fucking with me a little.
Fucking really?
He's really working it up. When you first meet them, you're like, Stuhlberg is fucking creepy. Brad is whatever. And then you get, like, the concept that one Brad is a cop, and that Brad was a cop who witnessed the other guy eating somebody and was like, nah, keep going. I want to see what this is about. Everything about that guy bothers.
Yes. Oh my God.
Marin and Lee also think so, and they get the fuck out of there. And so they decide to go to Iowa, where there's a fun carnival. Nothing bad ever happens at a carnival. They're having a nice romantic time on the Ferris wheel when Marin announces to Lee that she is hungry. She is still not at the level where she's cool with killing people, but she is cool enough with him killing somebody for her. He picks up a guy at the carnival and takes him out to the field to have a tryst. And then while he is jacking him off, slits his throat. And then they eat him in the cornfield. Nothing about this is okay. And it's even less okay when they go back to check on his home and they discover that he has a wife and kid there waiting for him that he did not tell him about, did not have any pictures of in his wallet. And they're real fucked up by this. Lee is trying to pretend like he's not fucked up by this because they need to fucking go and get out of there because people are already trying to figure out what happened to this dude. And Marin is still even more fucked up about the entire situation. Yeah. So
what
run.
I want to know is, did he have to jerk him off? Like, was jerking him off a kindness or cruelty?
I think it was a kindness because he did wait for him to finish. And as he was finishing, he killed him. Right.
Lee doesn't seem fucked upness to have that kind of Hannibal Lecter sense where it's like the meat's at its tenderest if you kill it right at the height of, like, joy. He's probably just enjoying himself up until then.
There is, like, an implied bisexual non-monogamy exhibitionism to it because he knows she's watching.
Yes. It's a complex situation, but I do think that he is, I mean, this is something he's done before, for sure, right?
For sure.
This is a modus for him.
Oh, yeah. He knows how to cruise.
Yeah.
And he knows how to wrap his hand around a cop, for sure.
And bruise, apparently. but I think that this is a thing that he has done. And I think that this is something that, you know, he's expecting her to be able to at least watch, but also partake in, unless the guy's dead and they can eat him. But I don't think he's got this Hannibal Lecter diabolical sense. But I do think that, like, if he's going to eat somebody that he's going to get off with, he's going to at least let the guy get off.
I like that. I object to the idea that his life is worth more because he's on the DL and has a wife and kids at home. Like, if he had killed a closeted gay bartender and they had been able to get off scot-free and, like, not, like, leave this, you know, she's like, he had a family. And it's like, okay, people's lives are not worth more if they have heteronormative families. I have a bone.
Yeah.
With that.
I mean, I think there's something to be said for the fact that he, like, by killing him, he has also ruined other people's lives rather than just one person's life. I think there's something to be said for that.
You could ruin a single closeted gay guy's. You could kill a single closeted gay guy who has fucking friends.
That's true.
Right. I mean, this is the logic of a, and I agree with both of you, but also, like, this is the flawed logic of an 18-year-old girl who is killing and eating people trying to convince herself she's still a good person.
Yeah.
That's a good point. That's a very good point.
Yeah. And I don't think
that's what it's ultimately about.
Because the main reason that Timothée Chalamet, so to speak, boned down on this guy was because he was being shitty to a kid. And that seems to be his sort of rules, is that he will find somebody who is generally shitty. But also, like, in this case, he's like...
But in this case, he was hot.
I mean, I wonder if that is a question of being shitty or if that is a question of trying to find somebody who is less likely to be missed quickly. I do agree that, like, there is not a good justification for anybody's life being worth more or less than anybody else's. I do think in the case of Maren, who is somebody who's grown up with one parent, it is sort of, like, striking to her that she has now been the cause of somebody else only having one parent.
Yeah.
And that is... you know, probably where a lot of that reaction is coming from.
Good call. Good call. I mean, this movie is psychologically complex enough that even though in some ways it's a very, like, lurid monster movie. Have you guys read the book? I haven't read the book.
Mm-hmm. I haven't read the book.
But it you can tell
it's... Except for nerds.
Pushes glasses up on notes.
Is there
eating people is for cool kids.
Yeah. They run out of Iowa, head to Minnesota. They get to the address on the birth certificate, and Maren meets her grandmother. Grandmother is dodgy, does not want to be part of this, does not really want to be associated with her, does not want to engage. But Maren sort of pushes it. She finds out from her that her mother was adopted. So the trace of being able to figure out what's going on with her basically ends at her mom, that the grandmother has sort of tried to cover up some of what she was, and that she says that the mom is not with them anymore, and eventually reveals that what she actually means is that the mom has checked herself into the state hospital. And so she's like, I've told you everything I'm going to tell you. Go talk to your mom if you want to find out more.
And the grandmother is played by Jessica Harper, the star of the original Suspiria.
Hey,
Luca Guadagnino directed the remake of Suspiria.
Yes, which we have talked about on here.
Yes.
So she goes to visit her mom. This is a truly traumatizing scene. The nurse takes her to go see her mom. She sees that her mom has gnawed off her own hands. And the nurse gives her a note that her mom has written all about how she should have helped her before and how far this has gone. And unfortunately, you know, if Maren is here, it means that her dad hasn't done what her mom asked him to do. And that there's only one thing that she can do to help Maren now, and that jump scare of an ending is that mom tries to bite her fucking throat out right there in the hospital.
Well, mom does such a good job of timing the ending of the letter to the attack.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
It's literally like, I need to kill you. And then she's like right there, ready to go.
She's been practicing in her head.
Yeah. Clara Sevigny understands a voiceover.
Yeah. She read this a lot. Like, she's had a lot of years to practice. She's like been timing in her head. She knows how long it takes to read this letter.
Marin is helpfully reading a lot of it out loud as she's going through. Yeah. Understandably, Marin freaks out and runs out of this place. Lee has to let her out because the door is locked from the outside. Lee is trying to calm her down, but Lee is really having trouble reading the room at this point because he's like, I also had horrible family issues. You just got to chill. And she's like, fuck that. My mom just tried to kill me. Unfortunately, Marin also doesn't know the extent of Lee's family issues yet. Marin is driving later and waits till Lee falls asleep, pulls over the car, and leaves him at the gas station. She fucks off into the woods and disappears. She's fucked up and ashamed about everything. There's also a speech or conversation between the two of them about how he thinks she is freaked out because she sees in him what is wrong with her. And it's the first time of her like really seeing herself. And that is why he is like projecting some of this onto him and feeling like they need to get away from each other, which I feel like is one of the like three or four scenes in this movie that somebody could do an entire TED talk on.
Yeah. The whole thing about being seen and seeing each other and like that connection being what it is and the complexity of that is pretty brilliant.
Yeah. She runs away to another gas station where a van pulls off the side of the road and greets her. And guess who's here? Has followed her all the way from Frederick, Maryland. It's her good buddy, Sully.
So normal.
Sully. This is the scene I wanted to talk about because Sully has been following her since Frederick, Maryland, which, you know, is halfway across the United States at this point. Yes, that is fucked up. Yes, that is scary. Every reaction Marin has to that is absolutely correct and valid. Also, this stuff that Sully says in this scene is so like interesting to me because there's a lot of like, she was the first person he's been like vulnerable with, the first person that he has felt connected to that. Well, he says he wanted to teach her. There's definitely a valid reading of this by Marin that there is something romantic intentional about this, or at least sexually intentional about this.
Yeah.
Which he
it's more it's or less not denies, good.
But it's,
yeah,
but there is like really something about the like Sully as an older guy who has never had this connection, who has never been able to share with somebody who he is and has come out to her in a way that he never has to anybody else and feels that he has been rejected by her. And like that is like a powerful feeling, despite how off and fucked up Sully is as well. It's just like a thing that I feel like we could talk about all day long.
Yeah, it's a really important part of relationship dynamics that I think a lot of people, especially people who practice polyamory and you know, a little bit more adventurous things, really do need to talk about. And I think it's a really important and kind of neglected issue. Is just literally talking about intimacy as an exchange. If you feel that there is something owed because you give somebody your intimacy, then that's a problem that a lot of people need to talk about. And I think that this situation is really great version of that because A, it's not necessarily about sex, but it's about desire. It's about
belonging, like chosen family. I mean, this is really a movie about the element of queerness that is about chosen family. Like whether you're fucking people or kissing them or not.
Yeah. And there's, I mean, as an ace person, like I can say that the longing is very deeply there. The connections that I've had with people, the kind of relationships that have not been sexual, but have been very complicated. That is something that is there no matter what, which is why I think it's interesting when we talk about something like cannibalism or whatever, you know, like this movie, this is a metaphor that is very sensational, but I think the sensation of it is not about how we feel about it, but it's about how the characters feel about it. And every character has their own way of defining what that means to them and how they deal with it. And the fact that it is cannibalism is not about looking at them and seeing how weird they are, but us seeing how they feel about why they're different. Whereas, you know, somebody who feels different might not necessarily be eating people, but there are times when they sure do feel like everybody thinks that they're a cannibal and they've said something or done something. They've kissed their best friend or whatever, and they feel like they've bitten their finger off and they have to leave town and never be seen again. Anyway, that's the trailer for my TED Talk. Stay tuned. I don't know if it'll ever show up. I have a lot of things to do. But anyway, this movie's good.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting sort of companion scene to the scene that Leah's talking about, like her feeling scared about, you know, seeing herself and somebody else for the first time is like, you know, there's clearly an element of menace to Sully, like of like,
oh, yeah,
if you don't accept this intimacy, then there will be consequences.
He's a nice guy. He's like, I was like, well, that's the problem with girls. They're just the nice cannibals. They go for the bad boy, Timothy Chalamet cannibals.
Yeah. There's also just like such a pathetic desperation to him. That
he is terror. What makes him pathetic and weak only heightens how dangerous and terrifying he is.
Yeah. And that's especially for anybody who has dealt with people who are socially above them. As you said, Tina, like that is such a relatable thing because they're nice now, but you feel like even though they're being nice, and if there's any point where you're like, I'm uncomfortable, then they get really upset because they're like, well, I'm being nice.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's a very like relatable situation for anybody who's been in that situation, which is a lot of people, you know, at least 50%, if not more, of the population of humans.
Yeah. And even this idea to like echo what everyone's saying, this idea of like, I've been so alone, but then we had a connection. It's like, dude, you didn't have a connection. Like what you were saying about exchange, like I made myself vulnerable to you. Yeah. You chose someone who was obviously vulnerable.
Yes.
And made yourself. Okay. So you opened up to them. Sure. It's so much entitlement and so much.
And for older guys, too.
Yeah. And there is a way that you can have compassion for this older man who is deeply lonely and has been treated like a monster by a lot of people. But like that doesn't give him an excuse to do any of the things that he does.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think like he is ultimately a messed up guy in a lot of ways, but I think there's something like extremely relatable in him, in that like to extend to the metaphor, he's, you know, an older generation of guy who has been closeted and been kept himself away from people, been alone, and wants this connection that he sees her and Lee experiencing, right? Like he wants to feel like he can be himself with somebody, but he's so, I don't know if it's maybe just a question of like, he's been alone so long and he's so sort of damaged that like, he's lying to himself, I think, even about who he is and what he is. They make a point of him talking in the third person. He talks a lot about Sully.
Yeah.
Who Sully is and what Sully's like. And even more so, it seems like when he's sort of stretching the truth about who he is, because he's trying to pretend in this scene like he is okay. Like she's left Lee, so obviously she needs somebody new to hang out with, and he's cool, he's there, you know, he understands. And the moment that like there's the least bit of rejection from her, and she is like very cautious and diplomatic about it, that she's just like, hey, I don't feel like I can trust you.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds great, but I do not feel like I can trust that you do what you are saying that you do. And he immediately flips. He does a 180, calls her the C word and several other things before getting in his van and storming off. Yeah, and getting super aggressive.
And I think that there's a bit of the pattern there of him separating, just completely denying his own self. Like he's basically separated these things, his personas out, and his vulnerable self versus his like ultimate, like his ideal identity, right? He has just formed this like a scab around this third person that he refers to himself, and that's how he deals with all of the fucked up shit and all the and I think it's in this case it's just the emotions, dealing with the emotions of that, whereas the kids are dealing with it in real time. But this is also like they're young and they're still figuring that shit out, but they are talking about it, and they're talking about it in a very real way. You know, I think that that is something very smartly referring to how people have been and have not been able to deal with things and what happens when you repress or divest or just force yourself out of yourself, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good movie about how homophobia is the real monstrosity.
Yeah.
You know, like the sort of allegorical, whether cannibalism is a metaphor for queerness or kinkiness or any kind of sort of like outsider misfit status, that like the social oppression that has made Sully so lonely has like curdled into violence.
Yeah. And he's internalized it.
And not killing and eating people violence, but also like calling a teenage girl a cunt for not wanting to get in his van violence.
Yeah. Yeah. The much more common aggression that a lot of...
I mean, that oh so common telltale immediate flipping as soon as he's given an unambiguous rejection, then it's just the whole facade just fucking slips.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like incel is a term that people are using more and more to just describe someone like a socially maladaptive white guy. Mm-hmm. And that's like fair enough. But like, as long as incel is actually an ideology that people are organizing and theorizing around and radicalizing each other to go on killing sprees around, I think it's important that we be specific about what involuntary celibate actually means. And I do actually think that Sully is a good example of the incel idea. Everything that we're talking about, the like, I'm entitled to love and sex and companionship, and if you don't give it to me, I'm going to immediately turn on you, is kind of what incels are all about.
Yeah, but essentially like the monetizing or the commodifying of vulnerability and intimacy. That's
and also the like nice guy thing that we've been talking about. Like,
yeah.
Like and nice guys finish last, and like that actually makes me the oppressed one.
Oof, too real.
And talk about tourism, you know, in terms of like dealing with like repression tourism, like Mr. What was his name? The character Brad or whatever. All that happens.
And so, meanwhile, we check in with Lee. He's woke up at the gas station alone. He decides that he's going to head home, seemingly resigned to things not being great. And it seems like he's almost at this point just sort of willing to like go die. You know,
I really wonder how long he was napping at that gas station with nobody bothering him.
When you eat a lot of meat, it makes you tired.
It does reflect one thing that I think this movie does a really good job of using location. These gigantic empty spaces are very out of the way. Tiny pockets of rural community. Just the sheer emptiness of middle America is very much almost like a character in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that is part of where it's important that this takes place in the late 80s, and that like there's not that sort of mass communication. The news is the most we get. And we get sort of clues to that from the bits of newscasts that we hear, and that they're, you know, contemporary stories to the late 80s.
I mean, I was born in the early 80s. So, you know, I wasn't eating people until the 90s when I came of age. But this movie did make me, I confess, nostalgic for a time that you could just fucking disappear.
Yeah. I definitely found myself going, they've been in the same fucking truck that they stole from the guy that they killed for like months. Like, how are they not getting busted yet? And I was like, well, I guess.
Busted by, there are no... Well, I was going to say no police. About that the guy. Only police we see is actively like, hey, I'm on your side, cannibal crew.
Yeah.
Team eat people.
Lee heads back to Kentucky. He seems to sort of be resigned to, at some point, getting caught, or at least just like he's going to spend some time with his sister and even his mom, who they have like real tension between them. And he's camping out by the river because his mom has sort of kicked him out of his aunt's house. We don't know. We don't even know how much his mom knows about what he is. Marin comes looking for Lee and finds his sister, Kayla, who we've met briefly previously, who tells her about their dad, who was an alcoholic who hit her and Lee on the same day that he disappeared. Lee apparently sent Kayla to go call the cops. She did. And by the time the cops arrived, they found Lee and both his dad and his dad's car were gone. Lee said that he had taken off after she went to go call the cops. and he was covered in blood, which according to them was his. We get the sense that Marion understands that this is not actually what happened, that, like, you know, Lee is responsible for his dad's death and or disappearance in some way. We learn from Lee slightly later on that Lee's dad was also an eater, tried to take a bite out of him, and Lee knocked him out, taped up everything but his nostrils, and drove his fucking car into an abandoned barn where he left him for 3 days before he came back and ate him, which understandably will fuck you up. Lee confesses all this to Marin as they're out on the road together again, and Marin tells him that he didn't do anything wrong, that she would have done the same thing. And they decide that now that they come to terms with who they are, they're going to go be people together for a while. They move to Ann Arbor, and she works at a bookshop, and I don't think
we ever find out exactly what he does. Great place to be
people. Yeah, and they invite Kayla up to visit. Kayla never makes it, though. Marin comes home, and you get a sense that she smells that something is off, or at least feels that something is off. She looks into the bedroom, and there is a familiar satchel on the bed with some hair sticking out. She moves to investigate, and Sully tackles her. Sully says that he just can't leave her alone. She knows too much about who Sully is, and he can't just let her be out there knowing him. It's fine that she doesn't care about him, but, you know, he just can't let her be. Lee arrives in the middle of this conversation. He can already smell what's happening. Apparently, he smelled him down the block. He jumps Sully with a plastic grocery bag, which, given that Lee has a knife, I don't understand this choice, but he does it, puts the bag over his head. There's some wrestling. Finally, Marion stabs Sully repeatedly, and they drag him to the bathtub, where Marion starts pulling at his organs until he finally dies. There's something more bothering her, so she goes to go check out the rope of hair, and we discover that among the hair is the telltale blonde hair of Lee's sister, Kayla, who Sully killed and ate as well. But the tragedy isn't over yet, as Lee stumbles in and collapses bloodily against the wall. He definitely got stabbed in the lung by Sully during the fight, and he is in the process of dying. Kayla wants to help him, take him to the doctor, something. His dying wish instead is for Marin to eat him and use, you know, him to sustain herself. We get several shots of the very bloody house after this eating finishes, and then the house having been cleaned up. And then she's off on the road again, and we get shots of her, I guess, remembering being with Lee fucking in this field in the middle of Montana. And Trent Reznor sings. And that's the end of the movie.
The movie. All movies should end with Trent Reznor singing.
Yes. I mean, if I saw this, I'm already kind of obsessed with it. But if I saw this movie when I was
14, I was going to ask, is this the kind of movie that almost like reverberated backwards through time and you've now loved since you were a teenager?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. 14-year-old, like, I have all of this going down to the strata, those nesting dolls of personalities that I have grown over the years, went straight in through and found 14-year-old Emily and, you know, gave her something that was a little bit less problematic than Natural Born Killers, a little bit less upsetting than Eraserhead.
This was the keyblade for your heart.
The keyblade. Trent Reznor fucking found, he like unlocked my heart, him and Sephiroth. That's just my fan fiction. Anyway, the point being, this movie's really good. And if you're a teenager and you watch it, watch out, you'll be obsessed with it. And I don't know, because like also with Yellow Jackets, there seems to be something about
Yellow Jackets, this, Hannibal. Cannibalism is gay.
Cannibalism can be gay. I'm going to put it that way.
It is like, if you love, it's like you men, you love other men so much, why you not eat him?
Yes.
No, also Raw, the French movie.
Oh, yeah, Raw.
Very gay, very sexual cannibalism.
I mean, fucking Savix, literally eating out. Like, it is, again, it is the metaphorical made literal of lust and gayness.
The only reason that I say it can be gay is because, you know, I don't want anyone, because there's still people out there that think that, like, Satan is flushing our kids down the toilet. And
the last fucking straight the last bit of straight cannibalism was the goddamn Donner Party.
Well, there was a sex chainsaw massacre. It's a little bit too
sexy, implying the non-sexy chainsaw massacres. Okay.
Well, I'm saying it's not gay.
Right.
There's definitely people are like, there's definitely shit going on there, but that's a totally different. It's going to go over here now. But
one thing that I liked about I'm very interested in the specifics of either like, how does magic work in this universe, or what kind of monster is this? And there are a few things about their monstrosity that are really interesting to me. We've talked about some of them, but the fact that they're not like vampires. I mean, there is something vampiric, and you could make a lot of, you could compare and contrast, you know, the vampire is outsider who passes as human, but like sustains itself like a parasite on humanity, and also obviously like horny as hell and seductive as hell. But there is something really specific about the man-eating in this construction of cannibalism, which is that they can eat regular food and they can actually survive, or regular food. They can eat human food. They can go to a diner and like chow down.
His breakfast of bacon and Lucky Charms.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like my boy. They can eat, you know, they can spatchcock a chicken or whatever it is. Like they can sustain themselves off of things that other humans eat. And sooner or later, they need to eat an entire human. And, you know, because it's also not just like, oh, I'll have like a little finger. It's like when they eat a person, they eat an entire fucking person, like a predator, like eating an entire deer, like a snake swallowing like an entire rodent. And that's interesting to me. It's not like what we do in the Shadows show where like someone eats a slice of pizza and then fucking pukes, right?
Right.
And like, that's interesting to me. And it almost, the fact that they almost starve themselves from the ultimate thing that sustains them, both on like a nutrition level, but on some more fulfilling level that in some ways seems sexual, in some ways seems like a sense of belonging, maybe even spiritual, just like something that's in their nature that they have to do. The fact that they kind of starve themselves from that and then gorge themselves, and the fact that they are all, not every eater that we meet, but definitely like the main characters are all like really skinny, sort of makes me feel like there's a little bit of like supernatural disordered eating going on with this movie. Like, that I guess I feel like you don't see that a lot in like man-eating monster predators. They're usually just like gorging themselves, and they need to eat human flesh or drink human blood or whatever, eat human brains. Like,
the eaters are gonna fucking kill it for the 90s heroin chic coming up.
Well, that's one of the things that was interesting is when Jake was talking to Lee, there was a point where he was talking about, you know, Lee was saying, well, I'm in control of myself. And Jake is like, I've met junkies just like you. Like, everybody says they're in control. And, you know, I think that there's the metaphor for drugs there. And I think it does go deeper than that, because it is not something that they choose. And not that the drugs are something that we always choose, right? But it is a thing that they have to live with.
I mean, I personally always choose drugs, but that's just me.
But I'm talking about like opioid addiction and stuff like that. Like, sometimes that is.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
I'm just being a shithead.
But there is a sense of inheritance too, right? And like, so the idea that you can pass on, I don't love like monstrosity is like a metaphor for addiction as much, because addiction is more complicated and people tend to put it into boxes. I suppose they do that with sexuality as well, but
yeah, I just, well, I have trouble seeing this totally as a metaphor for queerness and, you know, outside the box sexual preferences. Is it's the same limit that I find with, you know, X-Men as mutants as marginalized metaphor, is you do run into the sci-fi wellness of, yeah, but nobody has to die for two people to have gay sex.
Yeah. Yeah. But that, I mean, I think that that's where the metaphor is about how the characters feel about their own desires, right?
And how society treats them.
And how society
treats them. About Sully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the place where it feels strongest to me is sort of the smelling thing, like being able to smell each other. And that is something that she can't do at the beginning. She doesn't understand it. She doesn't know how to clock another cannibal. And then he knows immediately, like, you know, Sully knows, you know, can smell her from a mile away and, you know, uses that to sort of manipulate the situation. And that is, you know, that is a thing that she learns that she is able to do more as the, you know, the story goes on. But it I feel like more strongly than anything sort of directly relates to the experience of Gaydar and, you know, being queer and being able to sort of like clock other people and as opposed to like people just sort of just starting to understand who they are, or what they are, and sort of like figuring out what all of that means.
Yeah. There are definitely layers, which is, and you know, it's not very often that a movie can achieve a metaphor with that many layers and that kind of complexity.
Totally.
It's a good film. Good film.
My favorite line in the movie, I think, is they're having a fight. I think it's about, she's like, wait, is what we're doing bad? And, you know, Timmy's like been on his own for a while. And then they do like find this connection of like homo means same, right? Like they're the same. And I love the idea of them being like queer bisexuals with passing privilege can like go to Ann Arbor and like rent an apartment and work in the bookstore. But my favorite line is when he says, how dare you make this harder?
Yeah, that was a good line.
Because, you know, he's like, I've been suffering the most that I could possibly suffer. And then you see in Sully, it's like, no, there's more suffering. And it's actually like, it's harder to question the ethics of who you are and what you're doing. But if you just like let your like loneliness and self-hatred and how other people perceive you calcify, then like you end up like so.
I think this movie does a good job showing the almost intoxicating euphoria of finding someone like you and giving each other permission to be themselves. That I, you know, after a lifetime of hearing just the low-key societal hum of no homo, finding someone that says like, yeah, homo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very romantic. And I don't usually like romance in movies.
I mean, it's
I found this movie very romantic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the last image of the movie, them out in the wilderness together, it's a very beautiful final image to go out on.
Yeah. And a lot of the most romantic moments in the film are in dialogue, you know, which is another thing that needs to be part of romance and is, you know, where I think that romance and film really needs to build is that it needs to be communication based. And I think that, you know, being queer, you have to be able to communicate because, yeah, like you have to, like there's, and, you know, no matter who you are, and even like, you know, there's a lot of straight romance, which is completely built on the conceit that people are psychic about what each other want. And that's not the case. It is made up. It is fake, you know,
completely.
Anyway, it's just but I think that that's a good step in that direction. And what this movie talks about in terms of that romance, and this movie's feminist. That's, I'm going to say it. I think it is. It's
no arguments here on that front.
I hope she goes forth into the rest of her life with her first boyfriend, like incorporated into her, like to become one Spice Girl style, and and then like finds lots of girls to like nibble on their fingers.
Yes,
that should have been how the Spice Girls as a band ended, with a fight to the death when one of them absorbs the beings of the other four.
I was imagining something like a Dark Crystal situation where they become an ideal being, like all of them are, you know, it's kind of like Voltron.
The Spice Girl who devoured the sun.
Yeah, but then did you know in the original Golion, the reason that Golion is five lions, and the reason that Voltron, the robot, is five lions is because God was like, "You're too warlike. I'm going to split you apart." Did you know that?
No.
You learn something new every day.
Yeah, Golion mythos. It's got God in it, apparently.
Yeah, well, Golion is where Voltron came from. Voltron is Golion and another show blended together by people who didn't understand Japanese and it just made up what the characters were saying.
Yeah, it was fine.
Yeah, no, it worked. We got Voltron Legendary Defender based on that chimera. But anyway, this movie is feminist.
Yeah. Wait, one thing that we sort of skipped over is just another manifestation of everything that we've talked about more in depth with Sully, which is what happens to Chloe Sevigny. Like that's another metaphor for what you do if you internalize the messages that society like says that you're a monster, is that you like end up like institutionalized by the state, gnawing off your own hands.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, just resigning to the, well, I don't think it's, I don't want to say resigning, but like, you know, whether that is a choice of denial or an inflicted denial from drugs, you know, because like, you know, someone could be institutionalized, and, you know, it still happens that people are institutionalized for being queer. And
for sure.
Yeah. And to them, that might be the thing that they feel like they need to do, because they trust authority to fix it. And then they are, that, you know, drugs are inflicted on them, or, you know, treatments are inflicted on them, you know, and that people can be taken advantage of because they don't understand what they're going through very well. Yeah. So, you know,
that was really scary. That part.
Yeah. Yeah. And the mom, like, that was really, I mean, I thought that whole story was well represented with the mom. And, you know,
and also kind of like the fallacy of the idea that, like, again, going back to the theme of chosen family, that she's like, okay, well, if I find my biological mother, then we will just know when to understand each other and be instant besties, and then I'll understand myself better.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is kind of a representation of the fallacy that, like, that's just not always going to be the case. That, like, your blood is not always going to understand you as much as the cannibals you
made along the way.
Definite, like, fall in love with along the way.
Found family or advocating for a healthy romantic partnership over flawed familial relationships.
Yeah.
And just because you meet someone and they're also queer doesn't mean that you have to be best friends. Like, that's the other lesson of Sully, is that
sometimes there's Sully. I mean, I do feel like it is generally good lesson that if someone's referring themselves in the third person, just fucking steer clear of them.
Unless it's The Rock.
If somebody's like, well, like, we're both queer, so we're family, and also now you have to, like, do what I expect you to do. It's like, I don't know. That's a little pet peeve of mine.
Yeah.
I'm not available to every gay person in the world to give them moral support. Like,
also, sort of, let me define your queerness by my queerness is not.
Yeah, exactly.
Really, I consider it like an RPG party. I can support, like, six queer people at any given time. But
yeah, it depends. There's got to be, like, you know, boundaries and everything.
Like, three of them can be in your party. I can have queer people at any given time.
Yeah, I can have queer I can have as many queer people that I support as, like, it's like a Pokemon team. I gotta make sure that my queer people that have a good balance of strengths and weaknesses that cover each other.
Yeah, and then
leave
the rest
some
of them
nurse joy. Sometimes, you know,
some of them got to stay in the box because you got to catch them all. But some of them, you know, you just keep in the box and you message them every so often and send them gift cards and say like, miss you, XOXO.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you're like, ooh, hot pants and a mustache. Like, man, I haven't seen you since Gen 2.
I don't know if you're talking about a Pokemon or a Pokemon character, because I think those, you know,
Yes. Don't think about the metaphor too hard. I know I didn't.
So I was kind of what I appreciate about this, because we usually talk about race and social justice at this point. And I think what I appreciate about this movie, as opposed to, say, like early X-Men, is that this is a movie where it can be a metaphor about a thing and also still include the underrepresented communities for which this thing might be a metaphor. There are still queer people in this movie.
I thought you were going to say not directed by a criminal.
I'm talking about the early comic books of X-Men, not the early film of X-Men. Yeah, that there are still, like, that the main character is a woman of color, that we do have queer characters in this story still. Even though Marin's queerness is sort of up in the air, I mean, that first scene, as you were saying, feels very queer, but we don't get any sort of like real confirmation from her that she has romantic feelings beyond taste for girls. But I think, like, you know, very obviously Lee is bi, and we have some indication that Marin maybe as well. But I think, like, including those groups of people in the metaphor for the thing is important.
I totally agree with that. I feel like even when you get something like True Blood is like a very unsubtle metaphor for like vampires, like coming out of the coffin and like God hates fangs and all of that. Like, but then things get like a bit muddied about like sometimes it feels like it's an allegory for race in the South. And like, sometimes it feels like it's an allegory for queerness, but then like race and queerness like also exist in that world alongside vampires. Like, I feel like this does a much better job of managing like the coexistence of the like supernatural allegory and like the real life circumstances of how people would be treated without being too on the nose. Like Marin is not like, she doesn't feel tokenized, and it doesn't feel like they like hammer it over the head, even though like she like as a biracial Black woman, she would definitely be like treated a particular way, especially in like 80s America, like on the road.
There is a genuineness of her, of the way her character is portrayed, that does not feel like there are check boxes being listed of things that we need to know about her, you know what I mean? And then her family situation, that could be about class, it could be about race, it could be about the fact that her dad is on the run from trying to make sure that, you know, they don't get arrested for his daughter eating people, you know?
And also probably more difficult for, like, it doesn't seem like he's an eater. It seems like the white mom was an eater, but like, if he is the one who is like solely responsible for like keeping his daughter safe, like it would probably be harder for Black man in America in the 80s too. Like, if he is continuously like in hiding and on the run, like, I'm not saying abandoning her was the right thing to do, but it gives context to like what he must have been going through for the past 20 years or so.
Absolutely. And there's also a bit where her grandmother talks about how they didn't agree with the marriage and all this kind of stuff, and there was some sort of a rift there, you know, whether that could be about race or not, you know.
That feels so real to me. Not to harp too much on like extended family stuff, but the fact that like the grandmother knows that she has a daughter who is a cannibal and still is like, my daughter is too good to marry a Black man, is like fucking accurate and wild as hell. As a person just living in North Carolina,
who has racism is one hell of a drug.
Yeah, well, and this woman would rather admit that she's racist than that her daughter is a cannibal. You know, easily, and you know, that's just a bit of realness. Like, you know, it's an accurate, multifaceted depiction of these people's flaws. Yeah, and then there was something I wanted to mention about the cannibalism. There is a neurological disorder called Lechner-Hand syndrome, which at first glance maybe would have something to do with this, because it does have, there have been observed behaviors in folks who've had Lechner-Hand that they will, if they are close to somebody, or if, because part of the symptoms is that you chew on yourself, you bite your lips, you bite your fingers, and sometimes...
Oh, right.
There's a lot of, and it's not, this is crowbar separation with any sort of fetishism. This is because it comes with a whole bunch of other symptoms. It has a diagnosis, a medical diagnosis that has to do with the hormone imbalance. Mm. That. But there have been studies where people have observed those with Nitlish Nihan that they will try to eat somebody that they feel close with. Whoa. And it is sort of like the most ultimate manifestation of trust.
Damn.
With some of these folks. And, you know, I thought about that when I was watching the movie, and because I was trying to sort of look at all of the different ways these, you know, psychology and mental illness, disability, things like that could be portrayed here. And, you know, does that have a relationship with the Lesh Nihan disease? Because that's what initially when she bit the finger, I thought that's what the movie was going to be about.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And then it was not. And I'm glad. And it is really not. It is not. It's a cannibal thing. It's a magic thing. It's not Lesh Nihan. But I do recommend looking it up just so you know about it. Because, you know, we talk a lot about gay cannibals and stuff like that. And the metaphor of chewing on other people and eating other people and absorbing them, when there's, you know, there are actual neurological disorders out there that people will eat each other when they are, I don't like saying people will eat each other, but people will see the consumption of flesh as an intimacy, like literally.
Well, for the record, I do know people who are like highly trained in like medical fetish play who do enjoy consensually eating each other, and been described to me as very intimate and romantic. And there's a story I've heard from many people about these people sort of known for their like extreme kinks who went to a play party, and one of them was a surgeon and, you know, consensually like used a scalpel to like remove part of the other person's flesh, and then they got out of the camping stove and started cooking it. And they were kicked out of the party, not because they were practicing erotic cannibalism, but
yeah, no,
because not everyone at the party had consented to smelling cooking human flesh.
Oh, yeah. I mean, open flame too, but like, yeah, if this on a stove, yeah, like that, that's a sticky wicket.
I know a lot of cannibal fetishists who don't, like, I tell that story to like illustrate the fact that like, imposing it on someone because you're enjoying or maybe even getting off on shocking people is like, you could do that with the most vanilla thing in the world, right?
Yeah.
Like, so like getting off on like a fantasy of eating someone, or even like actually going through with it and like eating someone in a way that is not causing like undue mutilation, you know, like mm-hmm. the damage is permanent in like a body modification way, in the same way that like a tattoo is permanent, like or other forms of like consensual body modification. But like the thing that's fucked up about it is not like the transgression of the taboo of eating people. It's the like transgression of the taboo of like getting off on like other people's shock, which just like makes you an asshole. Going all the way back to that other Luke Guadagnino movie co-starring Armie Hammer, who had that whole big cannibalism scandal, sort of same deal, you know.
I write about this
in my book, like the thing that made him an asshole is like bringing this up non-consensually and like not being interested in doing it with people who were like had like mutual interest. And like that's the thing that is romantic and beautiful about both and all, is that which came out, I believe the movie came out after the Armie Hammer scandal,
yeah,
to yes. the point that they were asked about it, but like the book was written and it had been in production before that, so it was like weird timing where they kind of had to answer for it, but they were like, that actually has nothing to do with this movie. And the movie is kind of like a beautiful illustration of like mutual interest and desire.
Yeah, and the difference between consensual and non-consensual, and what that means with especially with like Sully and
or the fucking cop.
Like,
that cannibal fucking cop.
Tourist cop.
The cop who did not direct Green Room.
Brand. It's funny. I remember the Army Hammer scandal because
but did direct Pineapple Express.
Emily isn't feeling very in touch with reality right now, but Army Hammer scandal happened right when we were reviewing Hannibal, which was funny. Anyway.
For certain values of funny.
Yeah.
So, guys, do we recommend this movie to people?
Oh, definitely.
Fuck yes.
100%. Fuck yes.
Two backpacks, satchels full of human hair.
I would say, up. With the warning, which, I mean, if you listen to this, there's a good chance that you're fine with lots of gore. There is lots of gore in this movie. Literal gore and viscera.
Yeah, it sometimes seems kind of dissonant, right? Like, because it doesn't have the tone of a conventional horror movie. So sometimes it feels like you're kind of going on for a while being like, oh, this is like a American road trip period piece. Like, oh, God. You know?
I almost wish I knew nothing about this movie going in, because that scene at the sleepover is directed with such aplomb. It's such a jump scare of her just like looking at this nail polish on this girl's finger and slowly moving it toward it, and then being like, oh, is this a sex thing? Oh no, this is a eating a human.
Yeah, and even the actress whose finger gets bit off, it's like they're also under a glass coffee table, which is very 80s.
Yeah.
And
extremely 80s glass coffee
and
table.
She gives a great performance because you see the look on her face goes from ew, but like maybe I'm kind of into it, like, ooh, this is like gross but also scandalous, and then the pain sets in, and then like the fact that this person is fucked up sets in. It's really it's marvelous.
Yeah.
And I recommend say the 80s-ness of the sets in this, the amount of wood paneling that's in this movie is shocking amounts of wood paneling. I'd say I definitely recommend it, with that one sort of caveat of like there's gore, bad things happen, as too often in many of the movies we talk about. But is there a movie, something y'all would like to recommend coming out of this, whether it's related to this or not? Tina, is there something you would want to recommend to people?
Oh God, I forgot to think about this, all of my stuff that I said already about cannibalism. You know, I mean, I think we've talked about a lot of stuff that does a great job with cannibalism. I mean, I love Yellow Jackets. Would love to talk about that more in depth. I obviously love Hannibal. Yeah, Raw pairs well.
Raw
with
is
this
one
movie
we haven't talked about yet, but definitely we should at some point.
What's another? I mean, you know, there's definitely been some conversation of late about like, why are we so preoccupied with cannibalism? I mean, even zombie stories, even Last of Us in a way is kind of about like eating each other. You know, vampire movies are about eating each other. Yeah, I'll try to think. If you ever get a chance to see Mark Rylance do Shakespeare on Broadway, if you can arrange to have somebody have a heart attack in the middle of it, I recommend that.
You should not recommend that people arrange for other people to have a heart attack.
For a very good actor to, I don't know. Actually, that's going to...
BK do crimes.
BK do crimes.
Let me think if there's anything else related to this that I recommend. But yeah, Guadagnino movies. Love that guy.
Suspiria.
I love the Suspiria remake.
Yeah. Tilda Swinton in three different roles.
Oh my God.
Killing it.
Absolutely.
We're absolutely...
What about
no
y'all?
Reason, yeah.
Yeah.
Emily, what have you got to recommend?
Well, it's a couple things. There's another American Odyssey movie that's interesting that is about queerness. I haven't seen it in a million years, so I can't say how good it is about, you know, in the queerness category. But it does have River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves making out. And that would be My Own Private Idaho.
My Own Private Idaho. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. No gay subtext in that movie. That movie's just gay as hell.
Yeah. I'm just saying, like, I don't know if it is terribly comfortable, but it is definitely gay. And then, you know, a lot of this movie did, like, the comedy version of this movie is the Doom Generation, which is a lot more problematic, and but still kind of an interesting take from the 90s in the 90s and grotesque in its way, but nowhere near as sensitive. And off of the of like coming in from the outfield, I have I recommended Scavenger's Rain yet?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I recommend it again because it's really fucking good. And there should be more seasons and people should watch it. It is like so good. It's incredibly good.
It's on it's Max on, right now.
It's on Max right now. And it's animated and it's good and it's everything I want. And maybe you too will also want it.
Oh, you know what else is quite good lately about sort of cannibalism as allegory for sex and gender was Fresh. You guys see Fresh?
I haven't seen that.
I haven't seen it yet, but it's on the list.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked it.
All right, Ben, what do you have to recommend?
Yes, my recommendation is the 1996 Wachowski sisters film Bound, starring Gina Gershon and Jennifer Tilly.
Nice.
They're more just gay awakenings and also a little death.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, God.
I feel
that
like
movie has probably the greatest cinematic sex scene of all time. Actual butch bottoming hand sex choreographed by dyke pornographer Susie Bright, who also appears in the movie. Yeah, that, I mean, yeah, I second that. I cannot recommend Bound enough.
Yeah.
I'll watch it right now. Actually, I can't. By the next time we talk, I'll have watched it. I'll promise that.
Yeah. So it's been an interesting week for media for me, because I watched this early, just before this for the first time. I watched a little film called Heathers that I had never seen before.
What?
I had never seen Heathers before. I watched it. It's too late in my life to have watched it. If you're going to watch it, I think you should watch it much, much younger than I did at 39. Because watching it now, I'm just like I see what it is. I see them trying. They're not quite there yet, but like I see it. Some relevant stuff to today that feels a bit weird looking at it now because of the number of some of the things we've talked about in this episode that are sort of like almost treated as science fiction in that movie, of like, you know, men committing mass murders because they don't get what they want. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I would recommend Heathers. I feel like everybody should see it just because it's a cultural touchstone. But the third semi-traumatic thing that I watched this week was Alicia and I are still catching up on The Bear. The Bear is a good show overall. This week we watched an episode from the second season called Fishes.
Ooh, yes.
Which is
incredible.
A flashback episode that is somehow manages to be the most traumatic episode of an already incredibly stressful show. You get to see basically where this family broke down, but you get to see a lot of the characters who are more talked about or, you know, flashbacked in some of the stuff who, like, you don't normally get to see. And there are some just astounding performances by some of the, you know, some of the characters who are, or some of the actors and actresses who are cast as characters who are already dead by the time the show The Bear starts. But, you know, that show, just as we're talking about this just earlier this week, won several awards at the Emmys, and I think deservedly so. But this episode in particular has Jamie Lee Curtis as their mom, who does not show up in the rest of the show at all. It's, yeah, already presumably dead by the time the show has started. But it also has just, like, it has Bob Odenkirk as sort of their shitty uncle character. John Mulaney is sort of this, you know, guy who is somebody else in the family.
The craziness
and Sarah
of
Paulson.
John Mulaney. Yeah, the craziness of John Mulaney and Sarah Paulson as a romantic couple.
Yeah.
Fucking bonkers.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild. It has, like, Jillian Jacobs is in that episode as well. But, like, I think the standouts to me are both Jamie Lee Curtis and is the older brother, who is sort of the, like, impetus for a lot of the stuff that happens in the first season of The Bear, but you never meet because he's already committed suicide before that season. John Barenthal gives just an outstanding performance in this that, like, just talking about it, just thinking about it makes me tear up, because he is such a, like, real character. Like, you know, as a guy that I got to know playing, being in, like, The Walking Dead and The Punisher, like, John Bernthal gives this, like, performance as this guy who is, like, drowning, who already has mental illness issues, who is, like, everybody is just doing their best to not set him off. But he has just sort of this feeling of this, you know, this sort of, like, loose cannon in it that, like, you know, if you do or say the wrong thing around him, everybody's going to pay. Like, it's, you know, he's going to go off and it's going to be bad. And him and Bob Odenkirk have this sort of, like, back and forth throughout the episode that is just so, like, watching it, I was like, oh my God, this is the most, like, there's no episode of 24 that is this tense. Like, you know, there's no, like, crime drama that makes me, like, clench up the way that this episode does. But yeah, it's just like, it's an hour of television that is just, like, the most intense family drama I've ever seen. Like, it's incredible. So yeah, if you haven't watched the second season of The Bear, if you haven't made it to Fishes, it is basically a one-off that they sort of drop in the middle of the season. And it's the most incredible short film that I feel like I've ever seen. But yeah, it's definitely highly recommend that one. Not that The Bear really needs any more hype at this point, but it is a very good show.
Hell yeah.
Good to know. I've only heard about it abstractly, so.
Yeah, it is a very high tension show about a restaurant, about that I think more perfectly encapsulates the feeling of drowning than, like, any show I've ever watched. Or just, like, there being a thing on top of a thing on top of a thing, and you're just doing your best to get by. And, like, watching it, I'll just find myself on the edge of the couch just, like, chewing on my fingernails. It's just that amount of tension, and this episode is just so incredible. It's really great. Yeah, that's it for us. Tina, remind people where they can find you online, and again, about Deep Prog, which I think this is going to be coming out right at the beginning of March, so it should be out very soon for them.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Well, my website is tinahorn.net, so that's TINAHORN.net, and then I'm on Twitter. It's called Twitter, and Instagram at TINAHORNSASS, and you can... Yeah, if you go to my website, you can subscribe to my newsletter, where I mostly will just send out emails when I have an update on things and events and workshops and tour stuff and appearances and whatnot. Appearances like being on awesome horror podcasts like Progressively Horrified. And yeah, you know, if you're comics fans, you know the drill. Like, it helps so much to talk to your local comic book store and say this weird, gory, queer book about queer people by queer people with a butch protagonist. Like, I need to get my hands on it. Let them know, and that really helps us continue to be able to make it. And yeah, don't be a stranger. Let me know on the internet.
And you definitely about it. Do need to get your hands on it.
Yeah, get your hands on
Absolutely.
It. Get all over it.
Get more than
Thanks,
your
guys.
Get more than just your hands on it, for that matter.
Just like, rub it all over.
Yeah.
Really good.
Thanks for having me, y'all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming.
No, I've had a blast. Thank you so much for having us watch this movie. I am so happy. You know, 14-year-old Emily shouts from the past, thank you.
Yes. This was wonderful.
Yeah, this is one that's been on my list. I'm glad I had a excuse to make myself watch it, because
I feel like it was really underrated, so I'm glad that
apparently we
all enjoyed it.
I you know, being the Trent Reznor fan that I am, I hadn't heard about it, and he's like singing the song. He has a song that he does, like, he doesn't usually do the song for the movie. He, you know, he'll do the score and everything.
Yeah,
he usually doesn't bring his voice in, you know. I don't think he's done that since Lost Highway. But, you know, but don't quote me on that, because, you know, I'm already apparently a fake fan, because I had no idea that he did this for this movie. And this movie is, like, absolutely perfect for his kind of whole vibe.
Because the score is great, writing music.
Yeah. I mean, most
of the, you know, if you're a freak and you like things to feel, make you feel disturbed and atonal and dissonant.
There's a really great sleep mix on YouTube that's all his like ambient stuff.
Oh, it's cool.
Like Nine Inch Nails, Atticus Ross, you know, everything from A Warm Place to Ghosts to, you know, his scores and
Social Network.
Social Network. Emily, yeah.
If
you want to go to sleep thinking about Facebook.
If people need more tips on creepy stuff to listen to as they're going to sleep, where can they find you online?
You can find me at megamoth.net, megamoth on Patreon, mega_moth on Instagram. And Trentmeister, if you're out there, if I would love for you to score with me. As long as...
Did you just proposition Trent Reznor?
I'm sure he's used to it. As long as it's cool with his wife, she's awesome too. Marikeen Mandeek Reznor, she's absolutely gorgeous, wonderful, beautiful. Anyway, and, yeah.
Ben, while we're here, where can people find you? And is there anything you want to say to Trent Reznor?
No.
BenConComics.com.
Yeah, read my comics.
I want to say to Trent Reznor that he sounds great on Past the Mission, the Tori Amos song.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a big thing back in the day. Everyone was like, oh, Trent Reznor and Tori Amos are dating and having sex. And I'm like, you know, when I was 14, I'm like, no, he's mine. But then now I'm like, go, Tori Amos, fuck yeah, get it.
Ben, where can people
BenConComics.com. Just Google. No, don't Google because that's useless. Just find my shit. You know, got Captain Laserhawk and L. Campbell and Renegade Rule. Yeah, check out Renegade Rule. That shit's still good.
It's all good. Good, and get your hands on it.
Absolutely. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jerome58, on Blue Sky and Tumblr at Jeremy Whitley. My new book, The Cold Ever After, is already out for you in the future. It's still in the future for me at this point, but it is out from Titan Comics. Go pick it up. Go buy it. Help us make money and make comics. You can also still find The Dog Knight out there by myself and Brian to go. And of course, you can find the podcast on Patreon at Progressively Horrified, on our website at progressivelyhorrified.transistor.fm, and at Prog Horror Pod on Twitter, where we'd love to hear from you. And speaking of loving to hear from you, we would love that if you would rate and review this podcast wherever you are listening to it. Good reviews help us reach new listeners, which then helps us make more podcasts. Thanks again, as always, to Tina for joining us. Tina, it's always lovely to have you.
Y'all are going strong. You've been doing this for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah, a few seconds even.
Several, multiple seconds.
We're still at, like a good slasher villain, you can't keep us down.
No. We're back. Progressively Horrified X in space.
We've been at the bottom of that lake a few times, but we just keep getting back up.
Yeah.
All right.
The lake can keep us down.
Started from the bottom.
We've ended up back there a few times.
We're multi-level.
Sliding back down.
And we're having started from the bottom, and we're having fun.
All right. Thank you, as always, to all of you for listening. And until next time, stay horrified.